Welcome to Game and Going Deeper, a podcast series by the Gay Men's Brotherhood, where we talk about personal development, mental health, and sexuality. I am your host, Matt Lancidal. I am an intuitive life and spiritual coach and counselor. I specialize in teaching people how to heal shame and trauma and embody their authentic self so they can enjoy more meaningful connections in their lives. My area of expertise are working with highly sensitive people, empaths, and gay men to develop a stronger sense of self-worth. Today's topic is the science of healing, and we are joined by Ed Cohen. Welcome.
Hey, welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, good to have you here. I'm looking forward to unpacking this topic with you today. I want to just formally introduce you. So Ed is the author of On Learning to Heal, or What Medicine Doesn't Know, as well as A Body Worth Defending, Immunity, Biopolitics, and the Apotheosis of the Modern Body. I got it. He is professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at Rutgers University and hosts a therapeutic practice for people interested in healing, often with chronic and life-threatening ailments. And you have a PhD from Stanford in modern thought. I thought that was really cool, so I wanted to add that in here. Right up my alley. I love new thought, modern thought thinking. So yeah, this is exciting. I'm really happy to have you on here today. So what we're going to be unpacking, Ed's going to share a bit about his story and how he got into, the healing field and working in the space of healing and teaching. And so we're going to be looking at what we need to learn about healing. So why is this important? Talking about curing versus healing, how our culture places so much emphasis on the external elements of healing and negating that we as human beings have the ability to heal as an innate state of our being. Healing systems, so looking at all the systems of healing, psychosomatics, the relationship between the mind and the body, so the psychological aspects of healing the body. And then we're going to talk a bit about the psychology of healing, more specifically in the realms of sexual, because I know a lot of gay men relate to this area, and there's some developmental trauma for a lot of us as gay men when it comes to psychology and sexuality. So all right. So why don't we begin? Why don't you share a little bit about your story? What got you into doing all this?
Yeah. Oh, thanks for that intro, Matt. What got me into this was that I got really sick. I have had Crohn's disease for 50 years. So this is my golden anniversary, which I'm celebrating because when I was first diagnosed at the age of 13, it wasn't clear that I would last this long. It's a funny thing. It's like I say to my friends who are my age, everybody's complaining about getting old, and I'm like, no, bring it on, another year, it's fabulous, you know. I mean, that's one of the advantages of being very sick when you're very young. Not for everybody, but as I say, I was diagnosed with Crohn's, which I don't know if people know, but it's an autoimmune illness, and it basically affects the entire digestive tract from your mouth to your anus. And I got really, really sick on a cross-country trip with my family, and I started wasting and having uncontrollable diarrhea. And eventually I was hospitalized, and then took a while. And as I like to say, no orifice was left unprobed. And they finally told me that, you know, I had this thing called Crohn's disease, which, you know, they explained was an autoimmune illness. And though, you know, I had a pretty big vocabulary for a 13-year-old, autoimmunity was not one of my words. So I had to try to break it down. First, they said, well, it's like you're allergic to yourself, which didn't really get that one. So then they said, well, it's like part of yourself is rejecting itself. And I was still not quite on board with that. So finally they said, well, it's like you're eating yourself alive. Okay. Now I did understand what that was, but I don't think that was a super helpful way to explain anything to anyone, let alone a 13-year-old. And for the next 10 years, I was highly medicated. I was on massive doses of prednisone. If any of your listeners have ever been on prednisone, they'll know what a delight it is. But being on it for 10 years, basically, I call it a pharmaceutically induced mental illness. You know, the side effects of prednisone are, besides the physiological ones, which are like I was weighed 240 pounds and I had all these, my skin, I mean, it was, you know, I was a mess, but it also create, you know, induces anxiety, depression, mood swings. But, you know, because I was an adolescent, everybody just thought, oh, he's just an adolescent. So I now refer to that as my adolescence on steroids. And then when I was 23, when I was in graduate school, I got really, really sick. I had a small bowel perforation due to Crohn's. My bowel blocked off and burst, but it was undetected. And so then I ended up having all of these horrible infections, and which resulted in massive bleed outs that then... Unfortunately, at the time the final bleed out happened, I was actually in Stanford University Hospital, but I had one of those out-of-body near-death things going on, which was interesting, I have to say. Luckily, I was rushed to emergency surgery in time for my life to be saved. Then when I was recovering in the hospital, I started spontaneously going into these trances. You know, nothing in my life had really prepared me for this. I mean, like I like to joke, you know, well, it's not even a joke, it's true. But my parents were very devout atheists. My father was a physical chemist. My mother was a communist. You know, matter was all that mattered. So, you know, there was nothing in my life that prepared me for this experience of kind of moving into this kind of light-filled realm where I could take energy and just kind of wrap it around the parts of my body that had been, you know, surgically altered. You know, I just thought it was pain management. I was just like, okay, I can do this thing. And then I could just like slip into like some space that was just very peaceful, very lovely. You know, and I was out of it. And because I was in the hospital, you know, nurses and people would come in and it freaked them out because they couldn't get through to me. Mm-hmm. They figured out I was listening to music. They figured out if they shut off my music, I would come out of it. But the thing that really was striking about that was like, you know, I didn't really, you know, at the time know that anything was happening. But then when I left the hospital, I had an exit interview with my surgeon who, you know, he's a Stanford University, very handsome, actually very sexy surgeon, who said to me, "You're the sickest person I've operated on in 5 years who's still alive. And I don't know how you got better so quickly."
Wow.
And that really, so that was really the shocker. That that was the first time I really heard a doctor say, "I don't know," in that way, like, I don't know what's going on. But, you know, obviously also that it made me have to realize that I did almost just die, which, you know, at the time I didn't really want to take on. When I got out of the hospital, I had more stuff because then I was taken off the prednisone too quickly. And I had a drug-induced withdrawal, which caused dissociation and it was really a mess. But in the middle of that, I had this like really amazing experience one day walking in the woods where all of a sudden I felt like something like was coming into me from the earth or from the trees. And I just had this very clear intuition. I could either keep living the way that I had been living and then going through this kind of experience, or I could learn new ways to be. And I was like, I've tried the former. It's not so good. Let me do the latter. And it was really amazing because once I made that decision, suddenly like all of these teachers who I never would have been open to or interested in before began to emerge in my life. And that set me on this healing journey, which I've been doing for the last 40 years. I spent a long time doing many, many different kinds of healing modalities, body work, psychotherapy, spiritual, energy clearing. And for the last 20 years or so, I've had a counseling practice for people who are interested in healing. You know, often people with chronic and life-threatening illnesses, because there aren't a lot of really good modalities that people use. But in general, healing isn't just for people who are sick. Healing is a general possibility that's available to all living beings. And, yeah. You know, I think that the more that we can encourage and support it, not just as individuals, but collectively, you know, as political nations, states, whatever, but really the planet, at this point really needs a lot of healing. So, so I got into it, you know, out of personal interest. And then I stayed in it because I really found that not only it helped me, but I really believe that it's something that we all individually and collectively really need to give more value to. We really need to desire it more, and we need to value it more.
I fully agree. Fully agree. Well, thank you for sharing your story. I really appreciate that. And it sounds like you know, it was a struggle for you, but that's where a lot of your depth comes from, where a lot of your wisdom comes from, is through these experiences. And it opened up a door for you to be able to learn about maybe a side of the universe that you maybe wouldn't have if you didn't have this experience.
Oh, definitely. No, it was well, that's why my book is called On Learning to Heal, or What Medicine Doesn't Know. And one of the things that I try to suggest is that learning and healing are very related, that yeah. Healing always entails learning to heal. You never heal the same way twice.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, and my belief is that, you know, as long as we're alive, and even up to and including when we die, we can keep learning. Mm-hmm. There's no end to learning.
Yeah.
I have found, you know, that oftentimes, always, the very most difficult things that have ever happened to me, and I've had a many, opened different doorways. And, you know, because I had began to have an orientation, you know, towards desiring to learn, desiring to heal, that made it possible for those experiences not just to become obstacles, but to become opportunities, albeit ones my friend Ardell and I call them AFGO. That's our shorthand for it, another fucking growth opportunity.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's the silver lining of all of these, right? Like I grew up and struggled with addiction most of my teens and early 20s, and that's how I am, the person I am today, is I went through rehab. I started seeing counselors and, you know, deep diving into myself. I developed a spiritual practice because of this, and it led to my career, right? So it's really amazing how the things that we need to heal, you know, when we, you know, seek that knowledge and we learn, it opens us up. It opens our mind. It opens our heart. And it allows us to maybe get more on our soul path than we would have. I do really believe that. I think the universe is always nudging us. And sometimes the universe is nudging us through suffering and through illness and through these things to wake us up to see that something needs to be either changed or altered or whatever it might be. So yeah, powerful stuff. I'm curious for you, what does healing mean to you? How would you define it? Like what?
Well, my very simple, though complex, definition of healing. So healing is something that I think is available to all living beings. And so what I like to say is healing is our capacity as living organisms to enhance the quality of our life in the conditions in which we live.
Mm.
When biologists, you know, describe the functions that are common to the to organisms that they understand as living, you know, there's some basic phenomenon that seems to be generalizable. One is that organisms have to be bounded to the boundary has to be permeable, so we have to be able to let in nutrients and let out toxins. You know, organisms have to reproduce themselves in time, and organisms have to have a reparative capacity. They have to be able to encounter the world that they exist within and the challenges that they are presented with, and to go on living, there needs to be some capability of engaging and transforming in such a way that that they do go on living. And you know, so healing from, you know, the very first organisms, I would say, is an intrinsic aspect of what it means to be living. And, you know, hopefully we're all alive. I mean, I assume if people are listening to it, this podcast, they're alive. So, you know, so healing hopefully should be something. well, you never know. Somebody on the other side might be, you know, tapping yeah. in.
Yeah, of course. Maybe even through us. that's good. Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is that there is a strong element too in the environment plays a large role in, because you said the conditions to which we find ourselves in. Do you think that healing plays an important role on shifting the environment? So like, let's say if we are, you know, a gay man and we're struggling with in a certain environment, maybe it's a group of friends that we're hanging out with in the gay community, and we start going to therapy and we start working on ourselves, and that's going to change our environment, because our environment is always influencing us, right? So how much of this is like an individual thing versus how much is the environment playing a role in what's keeping us stuck in states of whether it be sickness or mental illness or anything like that?
So my understanding is that there is really per se no individual. Individuals always exist in contexts. Individuals and environments are a coupled system. So my favorite psychoanalyst, Donald Winnicott, well, I don't know if he's my favorite, but he's one of my favorites, makes this statement, you know, there's no baby. There's only a baby and an adult, right? Mm. And we're still that baby, really. We exist always in relationship to others in a coupled system. And so, you know, context is very significant in terms of, you know, how we live, how we grow, how, you know, the things that are challenging to us, the things that we need to overcome. So, yeah, but I also think it's a, you know, it's a reciprocal relationship. You know, we can change environments, and those changes, environmental changes, those contextual changes, you know, can change who we are, you know, by virtue of we've moved into a different space, you know, and conversely, you know, when we change ourselves, we also change those around us. I mean, that's, you know, for people who've been in therapy, you know, or been in any kind of healing, you know, modality, and you know, in relationship to friends or family, I mean, we often have the experiences of that people, like, I mean, I'll use the example of my father, who was like really, I mean, my father, yeah, well, I don't know what to, I'm just going to say he's a piece of work, but as I began to do more work, not only my relationship to my father changed, but my father changed. And by the end of his life, I was like, why weren't you my father when I was growing up? I mean, you know, it's like that, you know, it was palpable. So I think, you know, what I try to tell people is like, we do this work, we do it, you know, for ourselves, but we do it for ourselves with others, and we do it for others. You know, the problem I find in our culture is we're so focused on being isolated individuals. And to me, that's part of our great pathology. I think that's one of the things that gives rise to so much suffering, is that's just biologically counterfactual. Yeah. Like, we are always entangled with other beings. And how that dynamic, you know, unfolds is what our lives are. So very much, you know, we are very much context dependent beings, and, you know, and the work that we do for ourselves is also work that we do for others.
I agree. Yeah. I think even on a lineage level, like it's amazing when I do work on myself, like I notice the changes in my parents as well, because we're connected by energetic cords. So I find it amazing how you said that, you know, when you started doing this work, like your relationship with your father changed, but your father also changed as well. Absolutely. Do you find, there's a correlation between your Crohn's disease and your environment growing up? Like, was there any sort of relationship between those two things?
Yes. So, you know, I mean, retrospectively, what I like to say is getting Crohn's was brilliant. Like, Crohn's was a deep manifestation of somatic intelligence for me in that context, because I was very much suffering, but in a way that was not cognizable or recognizable either to others or to myself, but certainly not to my parents. And that getting really, like, being near death really woke them. It didn't wake me up that much because I was 13, but it really, you know, got other people's attention, which was good. Although they didn't really know how to help very much. But, you know, that's one of my suppositions, is that sometimes the things that we manifest in our lives, you know, in my interests, you know, are somatic, but, you know, also psychological, or are aspects of our intelligence. And, you know, like, and what I always say to people is, well, we're more intelligent than we know. That, what by that I mean, knowing is important, but it's not everything. And sometimes the ways that we know and the things that we believe we know actually are limits on how we can be in the world. And we actually are more intelligent than that. And sometimes we need to, sometimes when we come up against those limits, that we experience that as a crisis, whether that's an identity crisis. So, you know, like coming out, for example, for many people, is that kind of transformation. You know, the ways in which, you know, we are challenged to, you know, to be more than we understand we can be. And, you know, it's not everyone has the support and the encouragement. They're not in the right context in which, you know, they can do that. And so sometimes that does manifest, you know, as dysfunction, whether that's physiological dysfunction or psychological dysfunction. But yes, no, I feel like, you know, retroactively, I clearly understand that once I was able to be able, you know, begin to articulate some of the things that were limiting me, that the things that were symptoms of my dis-ease really fell away. I didn't need them anymore. You know, I don't want to generalize from my experience to everybody else's experience, but having worked with people for a long time, and, you know, I do notice that that does seem to be a kind of consistent possibility, that, you know, we have. And hopefully, you know, the idea is that the more that we appreciate that, the more that we value that as a possibility, the more that we can realize it in our lives. But it does oftentimes require, yeah, as you were saying before, changing our context, changing, you know, our relationship to the resources that are available to us.
Yeah.
Learn, you know, as I like to say, it often requires us to learn new ways to be.
Yeah. I like that. And I think, you know, I work more on the psychological side of things. I don't work with the somatics per se. And I see that a lot of, well, actually, I find it interesting when you said, like, the doctor described it to your Crohn's disease as your body rejecting itself. And in my practice, I work with a lot of people that are struggling with shame, and shame is it is about self-rejection, and it is about not loving parts of ourselves and feeling ashamed of these parts of ourselves. And for gay men in this context, it's, we don't feel comfortable being gay and sharing this with the world, and we hide that. And then that, I think that leads, and it manifests itself as disease when we're not living our authentic self. And the coming out process, I think, for a lot of people is more than just coming out. It is releasing density emotional density from our bodies that is has potential to become disease if we don't work with it. So it's pretty powerful. And I think a lot of people are going to relate to your share, what you just said about, you know, coming up against, I can't remember exactly what you said, but you said it's like coming up against something. What was it that you said?
A limit.
Yeah. Coming up against a limit. Right. And when you break past these limits, like actually for you, like what was it? What was that breakthrough that you had that you realized, okay, something needs to change here. And then you got yourself on the healing track.
Well, almost dying. That was a good one.
Yeah.
That was sort of like the limit of my life at that point.
Yeah.
You know, the context in which I had this experience was also a very intense context.
Mm-hmm.
So this was 1982, 1983. I was getting my PhD at Stanford in modern thought, as you mentioned before, in the Bay Area. And this was right at the very beginning of what came to be known as AIDS. And I was actually, when I was in the hospital, they, you know, because it wasn't clear what was wrong with me at the time, I had these infections, but they weren't able to figure out what was going on. And so the infectious diseases team came to my room, you know, because it was a teaching hospital, there's always a team, you know, it's like doctors and a bunch of residents and whatever. And, you know, I was an interesting case because they couldn't figure out what's wrong with me. And the CDC had just published the first piece about the, you know, gay men having Kaposi's. And so they came to my room and they said, we just read this article about, you know, gay men who are having, you know, these, you know, symptomatic, you know, infections. And it seems that it might be something that's sexually transmitted. Do you think that that might be, you know, something that you have? And I looked at them and I said, not unless you believe in immaculate infection. Because I had been incontinent for 10 years. I mean, really, sex was not, and I've been on prednisone. I mean, like, really, I mean, as much as I wanted to be having sex as a, you know, 20-year-old, that was not happening. You know, it's really like when you're like literally losing your shit all the time, that really is not something you want to share with other people.
Yeah, that's tough.
So, but, you know, in that context, you know, being so sick and then getting well. And then once I was physically better and I had started doing psychological, I started working with an amazing healer, woman named Rachel Naomi Remen, who is she's a bodhisattva, and she's written a number of best-selling books. She's fabulous. Through her, I started working at the San Francisco Hospice at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. And that was really, that was a shit show, actually, you know, because at that time, people were dying so quickly, you know, it was just like a revolving door of people dying. And it was amazing and also really difficult. And, you know, one of the ironies that I had was that my greatest risk of having seroconversion was through all of the blood transfusions that I had received, because there was no testing. You know, they didn't know what HIV was at the time. So, you know, in that context, you know, the beginning of my healing journey being at the time when I was living in San Francisco when everybody was so, so overwhelmed, you know, by the imminence of mortality and morbidity. That juxtaposition between my experience and what was going on around me really, that really stretched my capacity. I mean, I really had to grow a lot in order to encompass those, you know, oppositions. But, you know, as again, you know, retrospectively, I would say, but, you know, that is the thing, is like when we are often presented with these kind of polarities, you know, we can oftentimes collapse into one or the other, or we can grow big enough to encompass the oppositions. And, you know, so I think that, you know, that's, you know, one of the things that you know, I think is a good takeaway, you know, that I find for myself and for other people, is that, you know, I think this is what we were suggesting before, is that, I don't know if it's the universe or context or whatever, but we're constantly being prompted, incited to get bigger, to encompass more of the potential that we have, to be alive until the moment in which we're no longer alive. And then who knows? I don't know. That might be a really big context.
Infinite. Yeah, I feel like the word that sums that up is expansion. It's like we're always expanding into higher versions of ourselves. And I think the healing journey is a vessel, one of the main vessels I think that we use to clear out what isn't serving us, so we can become lighter, so we can ascend, we can move up higher into higher levels of consciousness. At least that's how it has been for me on my journey. So
yeah, well, we have to say though that you have in order to be able to do that, really one requires or benefits from a context in which there are resources and support. Like you were saying, you know, for you were in rehab, there were things available to you. Not everybody is fortunate enough to be able to be supported on, you know, on their transformational, you know, journeys. So, you know, while I absolutely hold to that as a possibility that is available to all of us, unfortunately, it's not something that everyone is supported in doing.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree. Yeah. And I'm definitely not supported in the things that they might need, because I think our system takes these cookie cutter models and tries to apply it to individuals. And I think that could be the segue into talking a bit about that, like how our culture places so much emphasis on external healing, but also they have these systems that they put onto people. And it's like, this is how you have to heal. So pharmaceuticals is a good example. Mm-hmm. It's very great in certain contexts, but you take that and put it into a different context and it's not helpful, right? It's very much can be a Band-Aid or working with the foliage of the illness, not the root, right? And I think I'm curious, what are your thoughts about that? What are your thoughts about maybe the ways in which modern medicine has limitations or fails us when it comes to healing?
So it's interesting that your first example was pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. Pharmaceutical, the word pharmaceutical comes from a Greek word, pharmakon. Mm-hmm. The Greek word pharmakon has three meanings. It means remedy, it means poison, and it also means scapegoat. So, you know, the point is that anything that can help you can also hurt you, and it can also be made to take the blame.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that's not to say that's to say things are not intrinsically good or bad for us, you know, in that, but that the question is, how do you enhance the therapeutic potential, minimize the toxic potentials, and stop blaming the things, you know, that, you know, may in fact just be resources that are available. I think that, you know, in general, I mean, I have a deep appreciation, you know, for contemporary medicine insofar as I'm still alive and I would be dead. So I'm not here to, like, you know, tell people don't go to the doctor.
Yeah.
But I am, you know, very clear that there are absolute limits to the way that modern medicine functions. One of which is that what made medicine modern in the sense that we now understand it at the beginning of the 20th century, especially in North America and the United States and Canada, was that there was a complete revision of medical education With the insistence that biochemical reductionism is the basis for all medical treatment. You know, biochemical reductionism just means that it's like what like if you're a pre-med, you have to take physics, you have to take calculus, you have to take physics, you have to take statistics, you have to take chemistry, you have to take biochemistry. Like that these, you know, are fundamental forces in the world, and that they basically explain everything that medicine is concerned with. And, you know, it may be the case, and it is the case, that those are necessary. They may be necessary to medical practice, but they may not be sufficient. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened when medicine shifted from being understood to be an art to being a science was that healing, which had been the central premise of medicine since medicine first began, which was like in the 4th, 5th century BCE, until the beginning of the 20th century, healing was what medicine was concerned with. It was called the vis medicatrix naturae, the healing power of nature. And then what doctors tried to do was support and encourage it. That's mm-hmm. what, you know, the Hippocratic oath is. That's what Galenic medicine is. It's only in the 20th century that the idea that medicine was a curative practice, and that the person doing the healing was the doctor, not the person, began to be the center of medical ideology. And also, you know, in earlier kinds of medical practices up until the 20th century, medicine was defined as humoral, basically, you know, humoral medicine, it's similar to like traditional Chinese medicine or like Ayurvedic medicine. The idea is like that there are four elements: earth, water, fire, air. They're modulated by four qualities: hot, cold, wet, dry. They are manifest in four humors: black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood. And that illnesses were imbalances among the humors. And but, you know, because the humors were, you know, constituted of the elements, that basically we are permeable to our environment. So they were really concerned with where you lived, how you lived, you know. The main technique that medicine could use for thousands of years was like in Greek, it's called dieteta. It's where we get our word diet from, although we have like a really reductive notion of diet. Dieteta in Greek means mode of life, right? That doctors were concerned with your mode of life. In Latin, it was regime, like regimen.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that for 2,500 years, that's what medicine did. Medicine attended to the ways that we live in the context in which we live and, you know, tried to help us to rebalance. It was only in the 19th and middle and end of 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, when scientific medicine was consolidating around bacteriology and immunology, that the idea that the organism was a separate entity, that it was separated from the environment, and that what was important for medicine was what occurred within our skin envelope, and that everything outside of us was somebody else's business. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, that is a limitation. I mean, that we certainly know a lot more about the functioning of organisms at, you know, cellular, molecular, even subatomic levels than we did before. And there are many kinds of interventions that can take place at those levels that are significant, you know, but nonetheless, we are always in the world, you know, and not to say that medicine, you know, can take care of all of the aspects of our being, but it can be aware of them, and it can be aware of its limitations. So, I mean, my book, you know, On Learning to Heal or What Medicine Doesn't Know, one of the main points is, well, healing was what medicine did or supported, what medicine supported for 2,500 years. But then at the beginning of the 20th century, when medicine changed its orientation, why did healing drop out? Healing is no longer part of medical discourse. It's no longer part of medical training. You know, even though people who are often drawn to, you know, working in in medical fields, nurses, doctors, dentists, whatever, you know, have a kind of vocational, you know, calling towards healing. That's not what they learn in school. That's actually what is learned out of them. And if you think about how physicians are trained, it's basically like a boot camp.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a healing process.
Yeah.
Like in their own experience, they are asked not to be oriented towards healing for themselves. And so how can they be for us? So I have a lot of sympathy, and I really appreciate, you know, what medicine can do. I really appreciate all of the people who work in the medical field, you know, but I also have a sense of how, there's tons of evidence about this, how frustrated they are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like one of the things that, you know, the COVID epidemic really made visible to so many people was just how debilitating this basic misunderstanding of what it means to be a living organism is for those people who are trying to help other people. Mm-hmm. So, that's, you know, I think medicine has a lot to offer, especially if you're acutely ill. If you're acutely ill,
yeah,
get yourself to a doctor. Chronic illness, they're not so good with.
I agree. Yeah. I think I kind of see like modern medicine is a little bit of like a, like you call it a boot camp, I call it like an indoctrination. They're indoctrinated into this belief that that like you said, that it's not about healing. I think where it shifted is in the Industrial Revolution, when these things became highly monetized, right? When big pharma started to monetize everything, and there was an infiltration of this ideology into the whole system, right? Where it became about money. And I think that's the problem, is that it's not about healing anymore. It's about profit. And this, I'm generally speaking, I'm not saying this in across all boards, but I do think that's when, where it comes, because if you have this giant company that is, or companies, sets of companies that are in charge of the healing, as soon as somebody's healed, they no longer need to consume that product. So I believe that there's a development of certain things that are like, let's keep people in states of sickness and not fully heal or educate them in what they need to do in order to take care of their bodies. So like diabetes is a perfect example of that. It, you know, instead of educating people how to take care of their bodies and manage their insulin if they're type 2, they just put them on these products that they're going to need to stay on forever because there's profit being earned. So it's frustrating. It's very frustrating. So I like what you said about how the doctors are now trained before they were encouraging healing, and now they look at it as if they are in charge of our healing. And I guess my question to you would be like, when do we reclaim that authority back? Because I see this all the time in not just medical circles, but I see this in like psychological circles where people are giving their authority over to other people. And when we're talking about healing, it's like, you know, I know a lot of people that go to doctors and they trust everything and anything their doctor tells them to do without question. They don't question, is this good? They don't listen to their own body and say, is this good for me? They just take it and they take it at face value, right? And I've been, I struggled with a bunch of medical things when I was younger, and I had a very similar experience to you, not as serious. And I learned from in my teens to start taking my health into my own hands. So I do my own research now. I make sure that I go to different professionals, naturopathic, traditional Chinese medicine, as well as allopathic medicine. And I look at which one is going to best serve me, as opposed to just looking at one professional and taking what they say and then giving them full authority over my body, right? So what can you share with the audience that can maybe create balance, because I know not everyone's going to want to do research and learn about their bodies, but where can we start to take maybe some reclaim some of our power and authority back to ourselves so the healing can come from within ourselves?
So we have to understand that our relationship with medical practitioners but any kind of figure of authority, I mean, lawyers too, or, you know, whatever,
yeah.
that When we approach them, we desire that they know something about us that we don't know.
Yeah.
Right. So that they are positioned as people who are supposed to know. And on the one hand, we suppose that they know, but on the other hand, for that, from their perspective, there's a lot of pressure that they're supposed to know.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like a, so it's a relationship that we engage in. And I think, you know, the key for me is around the issue of desire, like that we desire that they know. We desire that they know something about us that we don't know, and that they will be able to do something to repair what we experience as being wrong with us. And when I say wrong with us, I mean, whatever, we only notice things as symptoms insofar as they disrupt the ways that we would like to be living. Mm-hmm. Right. That's what, you know, calls things to our attention. I mean, most people have what medicine might, you know, consider to be pathological processes happening all the time. We do. That is constantly.
Yeah.
But they're not recognized as symptoms until we desire them to go away, mm-hmm. Or to desire them to be different. So, you know, that's why I like to say, you know, what I'm trying to encourage is that if we understand that we can desire healing, that we can value and desire it, then we can reclaim our own desire, right? And that, which then will change, it doesn't necessarily change, you know, the resources that are available. Or as you say, you know, we can still go to allopathic, you know, practitioners. We could go to other people as well, you know, but that if we understand that our desire is our desire, right? And that we need to own that and not, you know, try to offload it onto somebody else,
yes.
Right? That's, you know, that is the dynamic that, you know, we too often enter into when we get in these circumstances, whether it's like we have physiological symptoms or psychological symptoms or social symptoms or, you know, economic symptoms, you know, yeah. That, you know, is to understand, you know, what kinds of resourcefulness do we have access to, you know, in our own ways of being in the world. And yeah. Especially about things, you know, especially about things that concern the ways that we live, because nobody can know our lives in the way that we do.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean that, you know, in terms of like our whole life and whatever's happening to you, whether it's a physiological problem or a psychological problem or economic problem, it's not your whole life. It's part of your life. I mean, that was one of the transformational moments I had in my journey was I was very weirdly lucky. One of my best friends in graduate school, her father was the world's expert in Crohn's disease. He was Dr. Crohn's protege. He had Dr. Crohn's office on Fifth Avenue in New York. He had Dr. Crohn's desk. He had Dr. Crohn's filing cabinets. He was like this. And he was this old guy, you know, and I went to see him. And this was after I'd had, you know, my crisis, in my 20s. And he said to me this thing. He said, well, how has having Crohn's affected your life? And that was just like shocking to me because I thought, oh, you're saying that like my life and Crohn's are not the same, mm-hmm. like that my life is a context within which something like Crohn's has, you know, emerged and that, but there are other things. I mean, it really was shocking. I can't convey to you how important just a simple observation like that is. But I think in general, when, you know, when we're suffering, when things are painful, when things are challenging, oftentimes they do seem to take over our entire perspective.
Exactly.
you know, and we lose, you know, sense of like, no, we're always bigger than that. There's always more than that.
Yeah.
And the question is, how do we access that? And then that's why, you know, then we can say, okay, well, there's other kinds of practitioners who, you know, orient themselves to other kinds of resources, you know, that may be able to, you know, help us to call on some other capacity that, you know, we haven't really paid attention to, or we haven't really valued that much, you know, whether that be, you know, naturopathy or acupuncture or body work or breath or, you know, or, you know, psychotherapy or like energy healing, or listen, I've done everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same. I mean, yeah, there's barely a thing I have not done. I mean, and, you know, and I recommend some, and, you know, others, I mean, none of them have been deleterious, but, you know, I mean, and that's also about you. Like, you know, you're the one who knows if it's working or not, like if it's helpful or not. It may work for other people. It may not work for you, you know, for whatever reason.
Yes. Know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think this is a, you know, a good time to transition into the psychosomatics. And I just want to kind of let the listener know, like the psychosomatics is essentially how the psychology impacts the soma, which is the body, right? And how the thoughts we think and the beliefs we have and the feelings we have, like these are all going to impact the body and vice versa. So I'm curious, I wrote down this question, like, what does your illness mean to you? And not, it doesn't have to necessarily be directed at you, but how important is that question to the healing, like understanding the meaning? And I think you talked about it a bit before, but I'm curious if you have anything else further to say around just understanding the meaning of what something, about what your illness means to you and how that is a really important piece to the healing journey.
So to begin with psychosomatics. So psychosomatics is an attempt, like as a concept, is an attempt to redress an opposition that is a false opposition, which is between the opposition between psyche and soma. And, you know, I won't nerd out on you, but, well, I guess I'll
admit please do. I love it.
So the idea of that psyche and soma are different, actually is something that is first addressed in Plato's dialogue about the death of Socrates. And in Western culture, that is where we get the emergence of the idea that body and soul are different. Now, there's a whole really interesting backstory to that, where the notion of psyche itself, some people understand it to actually be something that emerged from earlier forms of shamanism. Pythagoras, you know, who was like 5 centuries before, was understood to be someone who could send his psyche, his soul, to another place where people would see him, even though his body was, you know, somewhere else. He also was believed to be able to know his past lives and his future lives to, I don't know, 20 generations. Don't ask me. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the opposition between psyche and soma is one that is particular to Western cultures. Like ancient Chinese thought did not have that opposition, mm-hmm. right? Just to, and, you know, which was an even greater empire at the time. And then that particular understanding was then taken up as the basis for Christianity. Christianity is basically Judaism plus Plato. So the opposition between psyche and soma, and as contemporary neurology, this is like, if you read any of these, you know, popular books about like what the brain does and what's mind, people, I mean, you know, like, no, nobody knows what mind is. It's not, you know, we know so little about brain function and neurology, and we know certain things, but one thing that we understand is like mind cannot be disembodied, like that, you know, although, you know, for much of Western history that people believe that, and that was like in philosophy, there's famous, you know, thought experiments, the brain in a vat, this is based on what's called Lockean philosophy, that, you know, okay, so if you are not really you, like you think you are, but you're like a brain in a vat, and you have, you're hooked up to some supercomputer that like gives you all these inputs that make you think that you're in a world that is the world that you live in, are you still you? I mean, really, this is people, like people get paid to think these shit. You know, I mean, I'm like, what the hell? So that's all to say, to my mind, psychosomatics is a necessary but maybe not sufficient way to redress a fundamental opposition, conceptual opposition in Western culture that I do think is pathological. I mean, that I do think that in the direct sense, I think it causes us to be ill. Yeah. You know, and so psychosomatic ill, you know, medicine. So a guy named George Grodek, who was a physician, a psychoanalyst, was an interlocutor with Freud, is the one who's considered to be the founder of psychosomatic medicine in the 1920s, 1930s, just at the point where medicine was taking on its scientific persona, right? So that, you know, there has been this kind of constant critique of the scientificity of medicine from some practicing physicians who understood its limitations. But, you know, the extent to which we are always living organisms, it seems to me, is a helpful perspective. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, as I was saying, I've done every kind of body work in the world. I mean, in part because, you know, the way that I grew up, and especially, you know, between, you know, the time I was diagnosed and the time I almost died, I was really very disembodied. I mean, I was, you know, identified with my head, and I didn't want to know what was going on beneath my, you know, below my neck. I mean, when you're incontinent, you know, you really don't, or like, let's put it this way, I didn't really want to identify very much with all that shit. Yeah. And so, you know, one of the really important aspects of my healing journey was to begin to learn that the ways that I imagined who I was were too limited. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really helped me, I mean, the first thing that I did was a practice called Feldenkrais, which is a kind of, it's a somatic practice. Feldenkrais is a really interesting person. I mean, really amazing person. He had a PhD from the Sorbonne in, I forget the exact title, but it was some sort of scientific engineering. He worked with the Curies developing their apparatus from which, you know, they discovered, you know, certain kinds of radiation that they got the Nobel Prize for. He then worked in, he's Jewish and he was in France, and then he moved to England during the Second World War. And basically he was a judo master and a soccer player, and he blew out his knees playing soccer. And, you know, basically at the time they didn't have, you know, like all of these part replacements that we have now. And they were like, well, nothing we can do for you. And he's like, fuck you. And he developed this practice that is, the trademark is called awareness through movement. And, you know, his idea was that, you know, so many of the kind of physical challenges that people are presented with are repetitive stress problems, that we use really limited ranges of motion, we use very limited ranges of neurological capacity, and that, you know, if we can stimulate other kinds of vital function, that actually we can, you know, we can live in more expansive ways, and the things that were impediments, you know, no longer challenge us in that way. I mean, and that was my first understanding. And the great thing about, for me, because of the way that I was, like in my head, awareness through movement is by using your awareness consciously to attend to the subtleties of movement in such a way that when you learn to move in new ways, you have, I mean, you know, not only are you transforming your muscular skeletal function, but you're using parts of your a lot light. Let's put it this way. I mean, it's not, you're lighting up new parts of your brain. It's, mm-hmm. you know, and from there, I mean, I mean, really, I am of the perspective that the most important things that I've ever learned in my life have been from the people who I've worked with who identify as working in the field of somatics. I mean, I've studied for 35 years with Emily Conrad and Susan Harper, who were the founders of a practice called Continuum that is a kind of movement meditation practice that is, you know, really profound and really amazing. So, apart from like my own like personal, you know, preferences for certain things, I think, you know, just to be reminded, you know, that we are living organisms and that as living organisms, whatever mental, spiritual, psychological capacities we have cannot be divorced from
exactly.
the materiality of our being, that it's a whole package, and that package actually is not even a package because it exists in a world. And if we live in toxic environments, whether those are psychologically toxic or actually materially toxic, you know, and let's face it, you know, that's the thing that we're, you know, becoming increasingly aware of. We're all living in a massively toxic, you know, environment right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that, like I teach, you know, 18 to 25 year olds, and, you know, they are really, really freaked out about what is going to happen to the world that they live in, you know, in their lifetime. I mean, I'm old, you know, but, you know, so I'm like, okay, maybe I'll, you know, I'm like, oh God, let me die before, you know, like, the, I mean, fortunately, and I live on a hill. I mean, like, you know, so I'm like, okay, I'm not going to be flooded, but that apprehension, you know, is, you know, it's material, like there's a toxification in the world, but the anxiety is psychological. I mean, yeah. You know, and it manifests in physical ways. I mean, the number of my students who have anxiety attacks, the number of my students who are on meds, you know,
yeah,
is, I mean, I've been teaching for 35 years at this university, and it is amazing now the difference between how young people were when I started in the late 80s and what's going on now. I mean, they are so much more challenged, yeah, at every level of their existence. And I think, you know, they are just, you know, because they're young, they're sensitive in a way that, you know, those of us who are older, you know, we're, you know, more, you know, to use the Reichian language, we're more armored, you know, we have more. And so I think, you know, in general, like using the idiom psychosomatic, whatever, you know, I think that we need to have much more capacious understandings of what it means to be alive,
mm-hmm.
You know, at every level, and to understand that our engagement as living beings is intimately entangled with the entire life world, right? That we are not little separate, you know, space capsules of flesh.
Yeah, exactly. I want to be mindful of time here because I know we got to wrap up. We're at the top of the hour, but maybe what I'll do is I'll have you on again and we'll talk about the psychological healing because I'd love to get your perspective on that. But I feel like that is going to open up a whole other, because that's where I probably want to chime in. So we'll have you back on. We'll have you back on and we'll explore some of that.
I'd love to come back. That'd be great.
Okay. Yeah, I really appreciate your wisdom today. I think it's really opening up a conversation about, you know, for me, what I got out of today is just the relationship between the mind and the body and the importance of holistic treatment when it comes to healing. Mm-hmm. And if the listener, you know, viewer listener, it's important to take some of that into your own authority back, right? And like, we have certain systems that just work with the body. but we have the mind, we have the body, we have the emotional self, we have the spiritual self, and they all need to be included in this healing journey. So I'm really taking that away strongly from what you shared with us today. And I think a lot of people are going to really benefit from this. So thank you very much for coming
on.
My
pleasure. No, my pleasure.
Yeah, and sharing all your wisdom with us. As far as people being able to connect with you, so if you go to healingcouncil.com, that's where you can find his Ed's website, and at Healing Council on Instagram, you're also there. And yeah, you're there. You got a presence. You got a presence.
I'm not much of a social media, but my website I'm very proud of.
Yeah, your website's beautiful. I reviewed it before jumping onto this call today, and you got a lot of really beautiful things going on, and I'll make sure everything's included in the show notes. And yeah, for people that are listening, viewing, please come and join us in the Gaiman's Brotherhood Facebook group if you have not already. And if you're listening on your favorite podcast platform, please leave us a review. If you enjoyed what you heard today, 5 stars would be great. Helps promote the podcast and get it into people's hands. And if you're watching on YouTube, feel free to leave us questions or comments in the descript or the comment area, and I'll make sure that Ed sees them as well. If there's any questions that you might have for him, I will forward them on to him. And yeah, again, much love. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. And thanks again, Ed. It's been great to have you here.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.